Hey, welcome to Canandaigua 1310, three men and a mic, and this is... I pretty much just said what it is.
Yeah, you did.
This is all Civil War Radio.
Oh, that's right. This is Civil War Radio with Armin Marinetti, and we have a special guest called... His name is... You know what, I'm just going to start. Mike really got me on the
screen. He's still steaming. Got the blood boiling.
Watching the ships roll in, and I watch them roll away again. Oh yeah, sit on the dock of the bay, watching the clouds roll away.
Welcome to the Combat Radio Network. This is Three Men and a Microphone, recorded inside the Iron Mike Studio, located in the Military Exchange on Route 332 in Canandaigua. Three Men and a Microphone is an opinion show based on the ins and outs, the news, politics, and scuttlebutt about town and the city of Canandaigua. Beautiful, historical Canandaigua, New York, where the hops grow higher, the grapes grow sweeter, and the sun always shines. In conjunction with 1310 AM, Canandaigua. Three men and a microphone, all the way from Rochester to Geneva, New York. I am your host, Corporal Tim Thornton, and this is Three Men and a Microphone. And we'll be right back after these messages. Introducing now, in the corner of Case's Mini Storage Plaza, wearing camouflage boxers and smoking a cigar, hailing from Canandaigua, New York, Corporal Tim Thornton's the all-new The Military Exchange. The Military Exchange is proud to present over 5,000 feet of pure 100% military. The Military Exchange is your source for all your military needs and proudly supports active reserve and former military, VFWs, legions, and leagues, Boy Scouts, Sea Cadets, Civil Air Patrol, and your family. Presenting cigars fresh from our plantation in the Dominica, collectibles, t-shirts, hoodies, and ball caps, rank and insignia uniforms for parade, security, and law enforcement, camouflage clothing, outerwear, wool pants, parkas, and field jackets, camping backpacks, tents, and sleep systems, vintage clothing and gear, Class A's, past and present, tactical and survival gear, antiques and airsoft, brand new and pre-enjoyed military camouflage and boots. Check out our military talk show at IronMikesMX.com. 5,000 feet to pure 100% military in Canandaigua, New York. Welcome to WOKR 1310, Three Men and a Mic, and this is Civil War Radio with Armin Marinetti and a special guest, Reed Robbins from the Conservative Committee, also an educator like our Armin Marinetti, and, of course, there it was, supposed to be filming it, and Mike Yarger from Canandaigua 2020, the saint himself, the defender of anybody who's not here, Mike Yarger. And here comes the boys from Scope. They're coming in the door, and they'll be on in about 20 minutes.
All right.
So, Armin. Yeah, I know. It's a heated show already. The off-air show has been going.
Yeah.
Tell us what we're going to talk about today. What's the 7th and 8th?
We're going to try to get to the 6th, 7th, and 8th amendments to our U.S. Constitution, if we can. If not, we might have to hold off to next week and finish it up, because I'm thinking that maybe we'll get through the 9th and 10th. So that's the Bill of Rights. We'll have that all in the next couple of weeks. Reed's going to help out here. Reed brought up a real good suggestion. I think after we get through the Bill of Rights that we might take a pause and do a little historical timelining and maybe do some of the arguments that were presented in the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers before we continue with the amendments that were added after the Bill of Rights, the 11th on up to, I think there's 27 or 28 amendments now. So let's start with a little bit of description of these amendments, and I don't think I have to do the reminder today.
No, I think we're good.
Okay, everybody's good. We're going to be civil. Okay, everybody's going to be Tim, don't give me that look. I see that look. Yeah, we've had a few fireworks already this morning, so we're going to have to just keep our heads down and our feet moving.
I was calm.
Yes, I was.
I walked in the door.
I should have kept my mouth shut.
St. Michael.
This guy. How come it doesn't blow up when you get near it?
All right, so let's go to the Sixth Amendment. What's the Sixth Amendment about? So I'm going to do a little bit of reading again because I like doing that, and it helps keep everybody on the same page. So the Sixth Amendment is talking about criminal prosecutions, those accused of a crime have a right to a speedy and public trial, as well as an impartial jury of the state and the district wherein the crime was committed. Now, as you can tell, I'm not reading it verbatim because I'm trying to speed things up a little bit here. The accused has the right to be informed of the nature of his crime and confronted by witnesses and assistance of counsel for his defense. Those are some of the main things in the Sixth Amendment. So let's break them down a little bit here. One of the resources that I used listed them out nice and easy, the seven important parts of this amendment are speedy trial, number two, public trial, number three, impartial jury, number four, the accused is to be notified of the circumstances and the nature of his situation, number five, the accused gets to confront witnesses, number six, you get to pick witnesses to speak up for you in your favor, and number seven, you have a right to lawyer. So those are the main principles of the Sixth Amendment. Now, I'm debating, should we talk about any cases now so we don't have to go back and forth and just keep moving on in order? So why don't we talk about some type of major cases for the Sixth Amendment now?
Sure.
Okay? You got anything that you would want to add? Okay.
Nothing right now.
Okay. Jump in anytime. Okay. If something comes to mind, you have a question. So doing research, again, I like to use uscourts.gov is one good source, as well as that funny name, OYE, that's O-Y-E-Z, .org is another source that I like to use. And I found some new ones, too, that I thought were pretty easy to follow. The one that was, it's called revolutionary-war-and-beyond.com. So I just found that this past week, and it's an easier to read website than some of the legal ones like Cornell Law. So here's probably one of the big Supreme Court cases dealing with the Sixth Amendment. It took place back in 1963. It's called Gideon versus Wainwright. And a little story is that Gideon was a drifter, and he was charged with breaking and entering in Florida, which is a felony. And he didn't have the money for an attorney. But he asked for one. And in Florida, they denied him because it didn't meet the Florida state criteria for having an attorney, which was it had to be a capital offense and you had to be destitute in order for them to assign an attorney for you. So capital offense, like we talked about last week, that meant you took someone's life. Okay? It's not capital like money. It's capital like a person's body, their head, their life. So he tried to defend himself, but he lost. And he appealed. And over a period of 5 years or so, it did work its way up to the Supreme Court because it did get shot down by the Florida State Supreme Court. But he won in the Supreme Court. It was a 9-0, a unanimous decision that Gideon used the Sixth Amendment to defend himself. And the result was that the Supreme Court said that a guarantee to counsel is fundamental to a fair trial. So they believed by Gideon being denied legal representation that his fundamental rights were also denied. So they gave him a chance to get an attorney and be retried. Now, I don't know how that ended up. I didn't see that in my research. So that could be something that we approach in the future. Okay? Any questions about that at all? So basically, he had the right for legal representation, even though he couldn't afford it. And one of the side notes that was mentioned is that out of court cases, Supreme Court cases like this, the federal laws were applied more and more to the states. And when we get to the 14th Amendment, we'll discuss that even more. But that's called incorporation. That's the legal term used when the federal laws are passed down and applied to the states as well. Okay? Can we move on?
Yep.
So far, so good? All right.
Sounds good.
I'm trying not to put anybody to sleep because it's early in the morning and some people are still getting the dust out of their eyes, so the Sandman stuff. So here we go. Moving right to the Seventh Amendment. This is a short one, too, so I'm going to read the Seventh Amendment. Let me get to the right page here. Excuse me while I fumble through the U.S. Constitution. The Seventh Amendment. This deals with common law cases. That means that it might be between two people and it's dealing maybe with damages or money. In suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of a trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. A little bit of history. Common law is something that was passed on from the British to America because they primarily owned most of the Americas way back when the Constitution was written in the late 1700s. So, I think what's most important to get out of it is that even if there's not a capital punishment situation where somebody's life has been taken, we have the right to a trial jury, and it extends to federal civil cases. Now, some of the terms that I noticed that are important that we hear kicked around a lot is that the plaintiff is the person that is doing the accusing. And they must prove the case by, quote, a preponderance of the evidence, which is more than half of the evidence. Now, again, we've talked about as you can see, there's a lot of wiggle room in some of these legal discussions. And we don't think that's totally by accident. It gives people work to do to figure out how they apply. Today's common use is in federal court. I want to use an example that I found. This was a little bit more difficult to research, but I did find something that took place in 1974. In the court case, the Supreme Court case, it's a civil suit. The name of the case is Curtis versus Lowther, Loether. And it was about the Fair Housing provision of the 1968 Civil Rights Act. Real simple. The person that brought the lawsuit felt that they were denied an apartment because of the color of their skin. And they believe that that violated the 1968 Civil Rights Act, which is federal law. So they were able to work all the way up to the Supreme Court. And it was decided 9-0, another unanimous decision, that this person can use the federal court system to protect their rights towards fair housing. And again, the 14th Amendment was mentioned in the decision. So I struggled with that. I had a hard time with that. But I guess the big picture is that our constitutional rights may go beyond what we're reading right here in the U.S. Constitution. And it depends. The court is deciding those case per case. Any questions about that?
About the Seventh Amendment?
Yeah.
So my first thought on the Seventh Amendment was where the value in controversy shall exceed $20. So $20 in $20 in you know, when this Constitution was written, you know, that seems a little low, you know, for nowadays standards. So I quickly looked it up, and it's $488 in
today's
$488 and 67 cents. So if we're looking at, you know, what type of things could be tried, I guess in in civil, there'd be anything above $488 constitutionally.
That's a real good point. I think that hurdle was so low intentionally, because during some of the research that I was doing, and God forgive me, I can't remember it all. I forget so much of it. I think the main concern why this was put into the Bill of Rights is that the king and the royalty of England were picking up people on the street for owing money to bankers and so on and throwing them in jail without really any defense. So that really affected the people of that time to the point where they wanted to make sure that that doesn't happen to numbers, masses of people. So there's a huge distinction between how a monarchy rules versus the new democratic republic. Okay? So that's my thoughts about that. Any right. questions?
So basically this thing says that you have a right to a trial by a jury.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I think what used to happen was that you had judges who were appointed by the king or whatever, so they basically had to answer to the king, making decisions about you. And this constitutional article was put in to say, wait a minute, you have a right to a trial by your peers, by people just like you,
mm-hmm.
you know, who make that decision. It's not the judge that's making the decision, it's your fellow people who make that decision on you. So it's an important protection.
Civil cases isn't ever going to have a jury. It's always going to be a judge, at least not at that dollar amount.
I'm not sure, because I think it varies by jurisdiction. So some districts, court districts, may have lower standards for a trial by jury. I think what these cases show is that there may be enough reason to get it all the way up to the Supreme Court level if that violation has something to do like with the Civil Rights Act, which is federal law. And think about that time period, 1968. I think Johnson was president in 1968. There were a lot of marches on Washington and other major cities throughout the nation. So it was a topic for its time. So that's why I think it went up to that level,
right?
The Supreme Court. So there's an opportunity there, and from the different cases I saw, which are very hard to distinguish and understand, it seems like the trend on the Supreme Court is that they don't mind listening to these cases. I think it gives them an opportunity to establish policy without going through lawmakers. So that's just my personal opinion. All right. Should we move on?
I agree with you, by the way. That's dead on.
Yeah.
The more they open the cases, the more, you know,
they can redefine the law.
Right, redefine the law. Someone versus someone. Yep. And then they use those cases to go further.
Yeah, it sends a message.
They set precedent that way.
Right. Yep. Okay, so let's move on to the Eighth Amendment. Let's see what the Eighth Amendment is about. So you know, it's interesting. While I was doing the research, I realized that these amendments don't impact a lot of us personally. But it does seem like the Supreme Court does handle a lot of these type of cases. So even though we may not have a direct impact on us, it filters down to us and everything that we do. So let's take a look at the Eighth Amendment. This is a short one. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. That's it. That's all it says. But it has, again, a lot of impact on us as a whole, as a society.
You hear often someone will say that the bail is unfair and judges will be questioned for the bail being too low or too high.
Yeah.
And that must be where they cite it.
Yeah.
And there's actually a movement afoot now with the judges and the attorneys to try to make sure that the bails are more reasonable so that the jails are not being filled up with indigent individuals who can't afford to pay the bail.
Right.
So,
to help me remember the different subjects in this amendment, it was funny to me that you've got bail, jail, and trial. they all end in that A-I-L suffix. So I'm going to have to go and look it up and see if that has some meaning. I like to see the origin of words, so I haven't had a chance to look that up yet. But I just thought it was odd that those three terms end in the same three letters. So you got bail, jail, and trial.
I'm always amazed at how many words, when I lived abroad in Germany, how many of their words actually seem like they're part of American words.
Yeah.
And I think, don't forget, we were only a couple votes away from speaking German
yep.
back then. So you could find the origin in German, Germanic.
Again, there's a lot of court cases that relate to this Eighth Amendment. And I found one that is kind of connected to what we try to do here on Three Men and a Mic and Civil War Radio. So I'm going to bring this one up. The case is called, and I might mispronounce this, Trope, T-R-O-P, versus Dulles. And Dulles was the Secretary of State at the time this case came to the Supreme Court, back in 1958. So here's the background. Albert Trope was a U.S. Army soldier stationed in Morocco in 1944, which was during World War II. He deserted and was missing for a number of years. When he resurfaced, he tried to get a U.S. passport as a U.S. citizen. It was denied using the 1940 Nationality Act that said that if you desert, you've lost your U.S. citizenship. So, the Second Circuit Appeals Court stuck with the lower court's decision and denied Mr. Trope the ability to become a U.S. citizen. But it worked its way up to the Supreme Court. And the ruling was 5-4. And remember the name Chief Justice Earl Warren? He was sitting on the bench back in 1958 when this case was heard. And he wrote the majority decision. And he said basically that the worst punishment that you can do to a person is to take their citizenship away.
Yeah, I agree.
So he said that it's the total destruction of an individual's status in an organized society to take his citizenship away. So that's why they gave him back his U.S. citizenship. Now, I don't know where it went from there. He was in the Army at the time. I don't know if the Army had any recourse.
He might have been, once he was picked up, returned back to the Army for, punitive.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's what they did with Bergdahl. Right. They're doing that right now.
Okay.
He's gone back to the Army to be court-martialed.
Okay.
And you're right, no one took away his citizenship. Someone said that once, a man without a home.
Yeah.
Without a country, right.
Without a country. Yeah, that would be awful.
So now, any comments before I go to my last little bit here? Anything, any thoughts, any comments?
On the Constitution?
Yeah.
Got to step up to the mic, though.
I'll back up here.
All right, one of the things I was thinking about as I was reading through it, and you asked me to read through it and think about it, is a lot of these things were based on what was happening in Great Britain at the time,
mm-hmm.
and on trial law that was happening in Great Britain at the time. And the Bill of Rights were written or really enforced and pushed onto the Constitution by the mm-hmm. Anti-Federalists.
Okay.
And in the debate between the Anti-Federalists and the Federalists, the Federalists pushing the Constitution and the Anti-Federalists saying, hey, no, we want our own individual states, our own individual rights as a state, and because they were worried about an oppressive federal government. Growing up, I've always thought, hey, the Federalists is the way to go all the time, every single time. But I'm starting to think as I, becoming older, seeing the things going on right now with going on the federal government, is we are... Get under you know, some of what the Anti-Federalists was pushing for. It took us a long time to get here because of the way the Federalists did it. You know, they made it purposely. They built the Constitution so it would change slowly so they can make smarter decisions. But the fact that we got to that, we're at this point where we're thinking the federal government, if all the punches are being thrown at the federal government, what happened to our local government? What happened to our state and county governments? You know, that's not what Alexis de Tocqueville wrote when he wrote On Democracy, mm-hmm. when he traveled around the United States thinking, you know, observing and going to take back democracy in the Republic to France. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to, as a community, start thinking about, and I'm glad you guys do this here with the Constitution, going through it and going through the Bill of Rights, and we need to start thinking about the punches should not be from any left or any right or any situation at the federal level, because when it comes to the federal level, we as citizens have a lot less say of what's going on at the federal level, because we're shouting with everybody else. You know, Chuck Schumer is not going to listen to a single word that I say, you know, and that's not necessarily right, because I'm a citizen of New York State. And whereas my local representatives, all the way down to the dog catcher, you know, the local is where it's strongest, the local is where it's better. And I really think that we might need to take some of that anti-federalist arguments a little bit back. And they're the ones who gave us these First 10 Amendments.
Yeah.
Go ahead. That was Reed Robbins from the Conservative Party in Ontario County. So people know.
Yep. And I think it's important that parties such as the Conservative Party remind us. You know, when you hear the word conservative, I define it this way. It's some conservative is that, you know, you want to keep what works. You want to conserve it like we do nature. And then you want to improve what needs to be improved. So I agree that I think first we have to improve what people know about our origin. And then that's why after we get through the Bill of Rights, we'll tackle the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist essays, how they tried to persuade people towards passing or ratifying the U.S. Constitution. But to bring this, and I'll finish up quickly here, there was something in the paper on Thursday, which was George Washington's birthday, and it said that the Supreme Court had a recent decision, 8-0, that these artifacts, Persian artifacts that are in a Chicago museum, could not be used to pay retribution to American families that were killed by Islamic terrorists, which I thought was kind of interesting. And I did a little research on here because I was thinking, well, you know, maybe this has something to do with the Seventh Amendment, and it's a reimbursement type case. And these people that had their family members killed back in 1997 were looking for compensation from Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran. So they thought what we can do is maybe there was $71.5 million judgment that hasn't been paid yet against Iran. So they said, well, let's take their valuables that are in this museum for part of our payment. Well, that didn't sit well with the Supreme Court because there's other federal law that protects other nations and their valuables from an American citizen. So as I was reading through the example, I was saying, geez, you know, it almost seems like the amendments that were written to protect us in this case have been interpreted to protect another nation.
Right. They've been unwritten to protect someone else. But you know what they could have done is the money that we give Iran every year, if there's lawsuits against them and it's deemed that they're guilty or whatever, judgments against them, they should take that money back out against anything that we give them.
Yeah. Now look at this.
Any foreign country. Does that.
This family, it's Reuben versus Islamic Republic of Iran. This family's been fighting for some type of justice since 1997 when their family member was killed by terrorists. And here we are,
so 20 years.
21 years later, and it's all in the courts, just getting to the Supreme Court.
Right.
So there's that for you young listeners, you want to look for a profession that will keep you busy the rest of your life, maybe law. It's something to consider.
Right. There's a lot of job security in that. You know, it's funny because what makes me think of something is they're still civilly going after OJ, even today, after he's been let out, this last time, I guess he's out. And so that civil case against him never ends. So that was Civil War Radio. We have Reed Robbins from Ontario County Conservative Party. Do you want to give a little shout-out,
yeah,
how people get a hold of you?
Yeah, sure. One quick thing. I've been reading a lot lately. One of the books I read was by Mike Lee, and it's Our Lost Constitution, The Willful Subversion of America's Founding Document. I highly recommend it. And it goes through some of, you know, how the Constitution, you know, and the Bill of Rights, how it came up with, who was the inspiration for some of our founding fathers, and then how court cases have changed that over the year. I highly recommend it. But I'm the chairperson of the Ontario County Conservative Party, and we are having our quarterly meeting on March 8th at 7 p.m. at the Ontario County Safety Training Center. That's 2914 County Road 48, March 8th at 7 p.m. So we're looking for members all over the county. We've got some vacancies, specifically Canandaigua Town, Victor, and Farmington have a lot of open seats, and we're ready and willing to get lots of new ideas. We're going to be vetting candidates. We've got, as you guys have been doing here, there's candidates from all over the county and for individual communities, and we're looking for people to input. It's hard for me, where I live up in the Port of Gibson, to keep track of everything that's going down in here at Canandaigua Town or into Victor. So it's best to have individuals who represent their own community. It's all about the local government, and we're going to have to stand strong going forward. So hopefully we'll see you guys on March 8th at 7 p.m. at the Ontario County Safety Training Center. And you can follow us on Facebook at the Ontario County Conservative Party. Thank you very much.
And that was Reed Robbins from Ontario County Conservative Party. And that Civil War Radio with Armin Marinetti. And we hope you two educators stay over as we're going to do our next segment with Scope. And Scope is the, now I can't remember what the S is for.
Shooters
Committee on Political Education.
Correct.
And I'm sure we have a lot to talk about today. Welcome to Civil War Radio, and this is our segment with the gentleman from Scope, and we have with us today Don Smith and Dick Hicks. And Don, what is your topic for today?
Topic for today is gun-free zones. Hmm. Unfortunately, we had another mass shooting occur in Parkland, Florida, and we're now talking about gun control once again. I did hear Wayne LaPierre from the NRA speaking on TV. He mentioned that 5 years ago we had a shooting in Connecticut. And he said the recommendations that were made then were not put in place. He said he wished, God wished, he said, that if they had been, we would not have had perhaps the incident in Parkland. You mentioned AR-15s, or so-called assault weapons, and actually the situation that we call gun control is not about AR-15s, or so-called assault weapons. It's about control. People will say, well, we can't have these guns. They're military-style weapons. Frankly, we did away with military-style weapons for the public back in 1934 when Congress passed the Firearms Act of 1934. The general public could not own a automatic rifle of any kind. The AR-15 is a semi-automatic. Yes, it can be made to fire more rapidly, perhaps by one person than another, but it is still a semi-automatic. Some folks won't agree that it's a sporting rifle. It's probably this country's most popular sporting rifle. It's used in a variety of ways, which have nothing to do with killing. It's used at gun ranges consistently. And to blame an inanimate object such as a gun is like blaming a vehicle for car deaths. But nonetheless, We have a segment of the population that will continue to focus on gun control. You may recall when the federal government in 1994 passed a so-called assault weapons ban, Senator Feinstein from California said she wished she had enough votes. She said she could have removed all of them from this country, every single so-called assault weapon. That ban lasted 10 years, and then it sunsetted. There have been various studies by government agencies, including the FBI, that said that ban for those 10 years did nothing to reduce crime. Because most crimes, frankly, do not occur by the use of these AR-15s. All right. The comeback then is, of course not. They only use them in a school where they can shoot a large number of individuals. Well, you're right, and a school is what we call a gun-free zone. And therein lies our problem. If you look at the, well, I don't want to say the word shooters, I hate to use that term, but the killers that have been involved in any of these mass killings, you will see one common denominator. They always pick a venue in which they know they will be safe. There's no guns there. They don't walk into a police station. They don't even walk onto a military base unless they are sure that the individuals on that base are unarmed. Recall Virginia.
Yep.
Virginia Tech. This guy knew that our soldiers were unarmed. In fact, the story went that the closest that they were to a firearm was 250 yards. So, obviously, he was safe. He was not going to be shot by any of these, and we're talking military soldiers, well-trained. He had no fear of them because they had no guns. If you look at the shooting that occurred in Colorado, Aurora, there was 9 or 10 different theaters that particular killer could have chosen. He chose the only one in that city that had a sign that said, no guns allowed. Okay? There's other incidents as well that we can point to. I found an article in the paper, which I thought was rather good. Dick and I were talking about this on the way over, in fact. He had not seen it, but here was a gentleman that put an article in a local paper. And he starts out, he's saying, in the wake of tragedies like the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, people want answers. They want solutions. But most of all, they want punishment. Well, that may or may not be true, but they certainly want a solution. And for many of them, it's gun control. What can we write as a law that would have prevented that? And there, frankly, are no laws that would have prevented it because it's only the law-abiding citizens that obey the laws. It's the criminals that will not obey them, regardless of how many laws you write. I don't blame anyone seeking an easy solution to this violence to want to pin the blame on something simple and obvious. So let's pick an inanimate object, something that cannot speak for itself, like this evil gun, this AR-15, and let's blame it for the actions of this murderer. How about opium? Opium has been banned in this country, you know how long? 1924.
Surprised it took that long.
Really? You need a prescription to obtain an opiate. Yet look at the opiates that come in from China through Mexico, etc. today. It's astounding. So is there opiate or are there opiates available? Certainly there are. Is there any connection between these opiates and these shootings? Yeah, absolutely.
Well, drugs, lithium, and how lithium split up.
That's right.
You know, was this kid in Florida, I said kid, this 19-year-old adult male,
yeah,
was he, you know, what level of medication was he on or wasn't he on?
Well, you're correct. I mean, something such as Zoloft has been used with young people. We don't know how this affects them, and particularly as they grow older. And if they're taking something like that at an early age, perhaps they move into the opiates as a result because, you know, they're hooked on them.
Right. We drugs, don't know. Drugs wear off. Prescription drugs, if you're given at a young age or any age,
yeah,
a couple years later, you might have to switch or that drug stops working.
That's right.
So you don't know when that drug stops working.
That's right. And, of course, if you can't get it from the doctor, they'll get it somewhere else.
That's where heroin comes in.
That's right. And we know we have a problem with that. At some point, you have to acknowledge the elephant in the room. People are making some bad choices. They're using an inanimate object incorrectly, and they pay the consequences. Now, this article claims that in the months before the shooting, and I believe this is true, the FBI was called twice by people who forwarded death threats and promises to, quote-unquote, shoot up the school. They didn't investigate. No one ever pressed charges. Now, one thing showed up on his record. Now, we talk about background checks. We have a system of background checks in this country. It's a NICS check. And by the way, did you know that it was the NRA that instituted that? Back in the 90s, when Clinton was president, he had a concern, and he did implement, I don't know whether it was an executive order or he got Congress to pass it, but it was basically a waiting period. When a person went into a store to buy a gun, they could institute a waiting period on that individual. What the NRA asked for, and in particular, Wayne LaPierre was involved in this at the time, they asked for an instant check on an individual. And this national instant check system called NICS was put into a place, and it's the FBI that keeps the records. Now, here's where the rub comes in. The only records that they can assimilate are those that are provided to them. So if a state, like Florida, doesn't provide the records on an individual, like this particular mass killer in Parkland, then the FBI has no idea that he's dangerous. Okay? Many, many, many individuals with felonies have slipped through the cracks because they have not been reported to the FBI. I've read articles on this. I've seen it on TV. There's a category in New York State and in other states I know as well called serious offenses. These would be individuals that perhaps have committed a felony. Anyone that falls in that category, has committed one of those so-called serious offenses, should be reported to the FBI. They would then be placed on the disqualified list by the FBI. Now, if you're going to buy a gun at a gun shop, there are three things that can happen. You fill out a 4473 form. You provide all the information that's required. Of course, if you lie on that, that's a felony into itself. But you can be denied, you can be delayed, or possibly you can pass immediately with this so-called instant check system. You know, many people have been delayed, and it may only be for a period of 24 to 72 hours. Other folks have been denied. If they're denied, there must be a reason for that. They must have a background, perhaps, that contains a felony. Guess what? Very, very few of these individuals are ever made to pay the price, shall we say. They walk out of the store. The name is there. It's been turned into the FBI. The FBI knows why they were rejected or denied. But for some reason, nobody ever follows up on it. Now, these guys may go into another shop and try again in a few weeks or a few months. They might pass. They shouldn't if they didn't pass the first time. But who knows? Maybe they'll buy their next gun on the street. You know, there's nothing to stop them there.
I think the Florida shooter, and I could be wrong, but I heard this on the radio, that he had one legal gun, two illegal guns. Yeah. Or they were talking about the last shooter before him.
Yeah, I don't know. They're talking about changing the age for someone to buy one of these rifles, AR-15s, from 18 to 21. Frankly, I don't see what good that's going to do, because if they want that gun badly enough, they'll either wait until they're 21, or they'll have someone buy it for them. Straw purchase. That's illegal, by the way.
He took his foster care's extra key to the safe that they didn't know they had.
Yeah.
And snuck the gun right out of the house. I mean, there's the... You know, the problem with this shooting is, Don, and I'm Tim Thornton, is he's managed to do damage to a lot of our solutions. So here's a gun that was in a safe in a family that was gun conscious. You know, they were willing to train and teach safety.
Right.
I believe the kid took advantage of their son and befriended him, probably for the sole purpose of having a way to sit long enough to plan something.
Right.
But then the second thing comes up, and we don't have to talk about it right now, but, you know, I had a resource officer in here yesterday, and we had a good talk. And, you know, as far as I was concerned 2 days ago, that was our answer, resource mm-hmm. officers. I have full confidence in the gentleman that I met, but now we have conflicting words or thoughts on mm-hmm. the resource officer down in Florida that was on the campus. And that's a nice way of saying, you know, was he indoors, was he outdoors, but he was on campus. But so that puts a little hole in our plan, because the resource officer, if we could get one for every school, would have helped us. Mm-hmm. I think I still believe in that idea. I still think that's the best idea going forward, or at least an immediate resolve.
Sure.
But it's a shame that we have, you know, a little bit of a nick there. And the same thing with the lack of the safe and lack of evidence or sharing of police statements. There was many police statements that could have been shared with maybe the FBI. I'll bring this up. I'm not normally don't jump in on you. I have a body armor policy here at the store. It's higher than New York State law. I like to live above the law. Sounds like I'm getting away with something, but I'm not. I actually detract in my way of making sales by raising the levels of law. So in my store, if you want to buy a knife, you got to, in New York State, I think you got to be 14. In my store, you got to be 16. If you add Goofy, it jumped right to 21 within a second.
Mm-hmm.
It's right away. You just don't even get one. Same thing with the body armor. There is no state statute in New York State that says you can't buy body armor. You can't possess it if you're a felon.
Mm-hmm.
But in my store, you have to do a background check of your county, and there's a reason for that, where your license is drawn, as opposed to... Or you have to have a pistol permit, because I believe the pistol permit's pretty accurate. You know, you would lose that if you did something wrong. So with the body armor and the county check, if you commit a misdemeanor or a felony in Wayne County, it doesn't show up so easily in Ontario County. So you want to do a background check on the county they live in.
Right.
And that's how I judge who gets to have a body armor. That's my corporate policy. And it was actually quoted once by the state police.
By the way, if you were an FFL and you had a gun shop here, you have the prerogative of not selling a gun to a prospective buyer. despite the fact that he has been passed by the FBI's next check.
So they can. That,
you can raise the bar.
Right to refusal.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Back to this article. This gentleman is saying that up to 1 to 2% of the population are sociopaths, and they frankly, according to him, do not know right from wrong. And if you're dealing with that type of individual, what warning signs are you looking for? What will you accept as a warning sign? There certainly were many of them in the case of this individual.
Yep.
Yeah. They were overlooked. This kid supposedly was torturing animals. Now, no gun made him do that.
Isn't that something? I wondered about that, because that's a clear sign of a sociopath.
It always has been.
And it's one of the first things you look for. You see any abuse to animals or little kids or people or whatever, and you know it's going to go further without help.
He threatened people with a knife. The knife didn't make him do that, nor did a gun.
Well, when you listen to all of these proposals, what actually, I mean, we've listened to a whole variety, and we've all thought in our head of a whole variety of things that could be done. But what actually stops the person with a gun? Is it only another person, a good person with a gun? I mean, if that's the case, I worked in the school system, and you know, there's maintenance guys, there's custodians, there's teachers, there's a variety of people, groundskeepers. If they want to take a course and stay fresh on how to shoot, if that's their goal, I'm going to protect the kids that I'm around. What is wrong? I don't know who's packing a gun. When I go in that place, could be 3 guns aimed at me in about 2 seconds. I don't know that. But that's the only thing that's going to stop me. Nothing else. We can pass all these laws in the world, but I'm telling you, if a guy walks in here right now and I don't have a gun, I'm probably dead. I might be lucky enough to throw a stool at him and hit him, but...
What do you think I'm here for?
Well...
Good. You're not getting in here. Did you notice the sandbags out front?
I did.
You know, access, though, is the key. Access. Yeah. You know, you've got school buildings out there with multiple entrances, and they're unlocked. You know, you have to lock those entrances. You've got to boil it down to one entrance, and that has to have someone, resource officer, for example, on duty.
I think there needs to be volunteers. I mean, you know, I know that everything you don't pay for and you can't regulate, then when something goes wrong, you have no way of you know, putting the blame on someone. But I'd like to see every resource officer that gets put into a school. I think this is going to become law anyways. And then have some volunteers, like, you know, parents of the kids, help go through bags, do like a TSA check as the kids come into school. I get it. We didn't want to do that to our kids. We wanted them to feel free. But you know what? This ain't the society that we live in. You know, I like what one gentleman said. You know, once 911 hit, 9/11 hit, we boosted up the TSA. We protected our airports. We put marshals on the plane. And then when Columbine hit, we didn't do the same thing for our kids.
You know, though, they've had TSA operatives, shall we say, government officials that have gotten through those screenings successfully.
You can fool
There's
them.
Nothing that's foolproof. We know that. But you don't leave yourself wide open, as we do with schools, with the so-called gun-free zones. You just can't do that.
Okay. This kid, this killer that we're talking about in Florida, he learned from the other shooters.
Oh, absolutely.
He learned. He listened.
The copycat effect is there. And by the way, the media is guilty of furnishing him with all of the information he needs.
That's right.
Daily, 24 hours, 7 days a week. That's all you hear about. Yeah. So why train these people on how to commit the next crime? I don't get it.
There was a time where news like this it would have been reported in fact and then left alone. And then, you know, evidence and like you said, videos and everything else and turning it into a political weapon probably wouldn't have happened prior to, I would say, the 50s.
Well, it's the politics. Look at our governor, the comments that he has made relative to the federal stage. You know, we know he has aspirations there. You know, by the way, this 19-year-old, was also stalking people. That was reported, but nothing was followed up on it. Let's say a human being decides to do heroin, or a human being decides to drive drunk, or a human being decides to shoot people. They weren't made to do it. They chose to do it. This was a decision they clearly made. And knowing that many of these killers do, in fact, plan this out over time. We're not talking weeks. We're talking sometimes years. Makes it even worse. So instead of saying, how can we limit access to these things, whether it be the heroin, the guns, the cars, or whatever, let's ask the real question. And I think this fellow has a real good point. Why do our kids want to do these things? Even if it's only 1% to 2%, why? It's not normal, and it's certainly not the fault of a car or a gun. I may have mentioned this before, Tim, the last time I was on here. If you go back to the 1950s, there was about 500,000 hospital beds in hospitals, psychiatric hospitals, that were available for patients, perhaps like this killer in Parkland, Florida. And we today have less than 50,000 nationwide. That's an issue that should be looked at, very definitely. If a rising number, and Dick was referring to this, a rising number of young people do not know right from wrong, then that's the issue. The cops were called to this Parkland shooter's house, guess how many times? 36 times. These were crimes ranging from domestic abuse, theft, threats, torturing of animals, to shooting at neighbors' livestock. These are all misdemeanors and felonies. What happened? Why did he fall through the cracks? Before that, he was kicked out of 3 schools for disciplinary problems where the police were called. He was accused of death threats with weapons, stalking, etc. If you begin to look at guns, think about it. In this country, we've got over 500,000 guns. But compare that with the number that are used in crimes, probably a handful. There are 250 million cars, and again, a small minority of those are used in the wrong way. These are all used by criminals. Can we figure out what the common element here is? It's an attitude, according to this writer. It's a criminal attitude, period. Instead of asking, how do they get this, or how do we regulate that, or what new law can we create, let's ask, why so many kids want to hurt one another? Why do they want to do drugs?
Thank you for listening to the Combat Radio Network. On Channel 1310 WOKR, this has been the Civil War Radio. And coming up next, 3 men and a microphone. You can check us out every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. and every Sunday afternoon, an encore performance, 2 in the afternoon to 4 p.m. Thank you again for listening to Combat Radio Network, brought to you by the Military Exchange in Canandaigua, where they are 5,000 feet of pure 100% military.